Week is Julia Dolan. She is the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. And she's here talking about representing vernacular portraits of, by, and for African Americans. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Julia.
Thank you.
So this is a new show, and it's something I've never seen in a museum before. It's vernacular photographs. It's photo album photos, as I think of them. It's prints that you would normally see in a person's album. It goes back to studio photography, and it goes all the way forward to Polaroids. And it's very kind of gritty. There's no, you know, there's no high artistry in many of these pictures. So just tell us where this all came from.
This exhibition came about almost exactly 2 years ago. A friend of mine named Larry Clark, who happens to be a vintage and antiques dealer here in Portland, started posting these incredible 19th and early 20th century photographs on his Instagram account. I follow him on Instagram, and I saw...
What's his name?
Larry Clark.
And on Instagram? Larry Clark?
Primitive Modern.
Okay.
Primitive Modern. And he posts so many wonderful things, and he has a real interest in photography as well. And he showed a number of photographs of African Americans. It's one thing to see a 19th century photograph. They're very common. There are probably hundreds of millions of them, perhaps still. But to see a number of them in a row of African Americans, that is a subject matter that we don't see quite as often. And so I actually contacted him through Instagram and said, when are you going to let me see these photographs? And I went over when my schedule finally permitted, and he showed me this album full of images and then some loose photographs as well that he had purchased at an estate sale in North Portland. And I said to him, these are incredible and special, and we should keep them here in Portland. And I need to show these to the public.
And how long did it take to get them all to the state where you could hang them?
Well, it took about 2 years between accessioning the album, finding some funds to purchase it, having it go through our board, studying the works in the album to see if we could figure out who was who and where did they come from, and then also working with two other collectors of snapshots and Polaroids to flesh out the concept of the African American in everyday photographs a little further and make it even richer in order to give people a kind of multi-layered and long-term view of African Americans using photography within their own families and communities. The whole process took about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So some of the things that caught my eye were the very sort of 70s Polaroids of families. You've got people celebrating graduation. You've got dudes leaning against their cars, birthday parties. I mean, you know, like these are interior shots that are either lit by a flash or, you know, these are like the pictures you take yourself, or you would have in the old days.
Yes. And I was going to say that could be generational. A number of people my age and around my age are very interested in the Polaroids because we grew up with those and are used to that type of photographic language in our own families. What is incredible, though, when we look at the 19th century photographs of little carte de visites or greeting, they're like greeting cards. They're cards you would give to friends and family members, and then cabinet cards, which are larger portrait photos. Those were produced at rates very similar to, say, the Polaroid at that time, where you would have multiples of them and you would give them to different family members and friends. So they would be the Polaroid of the 19th century. Tintypes are the same.
Sorry, it was a carte de visite like a calling card for the gentry, where they would visit each other, like in a Henry James book, and they're always visiting each other?
Yes, it could be. And Queen Victoria had hundreds of albums of carte de visite. She loved the carte de visite. She loved photography.
She hoarded them.
But, absolutely. And then people would actually make their own photo albums of celebrities. And so she had many made of her, and people could purchase them from different studios and put Queen Victoria Victoria into their own album with family members and friends. But it didn't necessarily have to be gentry or, you know, the upper middle classes or upper classes. As time went on and the industrial process got better and easier and less expensive, carte de visites, tintypes, cabinet cards also became inexpensive. So people in the working classes and lower middle classes could also purchase and distribute these types of photographs.
So like if we would go to a photo booth, you know, mm-hmm. in the 60s and get our picture taken for a few pennies, in what were we talking like 1890 or something?
Earlier, after the Civil War, as the tintype became even more popular, and it was already popular during the Civil War. Civil War soldiers would actually have them made in the field and then would mail them back to loved ones, and vice versa whenever possible. They took off even further after that. And by the early 1870s, you could have some not so great, but still tintypes made for upwards of maybe 5 cents, which is less than a dollar today.
Wow. That's amazing.
So this allowed for a lot of people to have images of themselves and people they cared about.
And what is a tintype?
A tintype is, it's a long story, but it's a wet collodion process, and it's an actual surface of iron. It's not tin. And on that surface is laid a negative that is exposed in a certain way on that piece of metal so that it actually looks like a positive. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different thing from the types of photographs we see now that are on pieces of paper. And tintypes lasted actually all the way until the 1940s or so. On Coney Island, you could still get a tintype. People in town actually make them today. They're very beautiful artistic images. It's a really beloved analog process, and you can still make them today, but it's a photograph that rests on a piece of metal. That's why it was so useful for soldiers in the army during mm-hmm. the Civil War to send them back and forth, because you could mail it through the mail because it was on a piece of metal.
And it wouldn't be affected by moisture, so it lasts a long time.
Well, it can rust. Yeah, it can rust. So at the beginning, no, it wouldn't be affected by moisture, but 25-30 years later, we are seeing, you know, signs of rust on them and scratching. The mm-hmm. emulsion can get pulled off pretty easily.
So when you go into the gallery, you know, your gallery is the what floor are you on, the third?
I am on 2M, mezzanine.
Okay.
And you have to go from the main building. You have to take the Link Gallery underground and then either take the steps or the elevator up into the Center for Modern and Contemporary Art. And that's where my permanent photo gallery space is.
Mm-hmm. So you go into your gallery, it's, you know, this windowless long space.
Yes.
It's nice. It's a very
it's
peaceful
intimate.
Place.
It is peaceful and it's intimate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But one of the pride of place images is this framed portrait of a woman. Just tell us who she is.
So this is a last-minute addition that came to the museum on Thursday, and the exhibition opened on Saturday. This is an incredible portrait of Molly Foster, and it is called a charcoal portrait. It was probably made around 1885 or 1890. A charcoal portrait was one of the first enlargement photographs that people could use. Typically, whatever your photograph negative size was at the time, whether you had a 4x5 or an 8x10 analog camera in the 1850s, 60s, or 70s, the size of your negative was the size of your print. And it wasn't until certain kind of basic systems were created using solar light, so light from the sun through lenses, where a negative could be enlarged onto a photosensitive piece of paper to make an image that was larger than the negative itself. And so Molly Foster's picture is almost life-size. The issue with charcoal portraits from those days is that because the chemistry and the lens enlarging system was so new and not very high tech, if you will, you would see every flaw in the negative, every piece of dust, every blemish, you know, that kind of thing. So what people started doing is they would make the enlargements and make this photographic print. And then in order to get rid of all of the inconsistencies and little mistakes, they would add charcoal or pastel or even paint over them. And they became very, very popular. They're almost half photograph, half drawing. So they're really interesting when you look at them because they feel like a photograph, mm-hmm. but they look like a drawing. But because we're so used to photographic portraits, we, I think, internally can almost feel that they're photographic somehow. And that's because individuals were drawing and painting over the photograph. Mm-hmm. So this exquisite portrait of Molly Foster, it's in its original frame. It comes from the family where Larry Clark got the photo album. Larry purchased it at an estate sale, as I mentioned, in North Portland. And I finally, just about a week before the exhibition, was able to make contact with that family. And we were able to figure out how the album made its way into the estate sale in the first place, and then started making connections about how that album moved across half of the country, in fact. And we realized that it most likely came with Molly Foster in 1918. Molly, whose image is in this wonderful charcoal portrait, was born in the Midwest and then moved out to Portland around 1918, perhaps to follow her daughter Noni, who moved out here and married here and had two sons here. So almost all of the photographs that came with the grouping that we purchased from Larry are portraits from the Midwest, from Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, Illinois. There are some from Tennessee. There's one from Washington, D.C. So it's this wonderful thought about movement and how African Americans were moving into different parts of the country, which of course is very interesting here in Oregon because we had exclusionary laws on the books for so long. Mm-hmm. And when we became a state in, what was it, 1859, I believe, you were not allowed to be African American and live here. Mm-hmm. You could not own property here. And so how does migration happen? Where were you allowed to live and be in the city as time went on? And then how did you have to migrate either within the city or away from it again? Who was coming here and why? The album opens up all these questions.
The actual title of the show is Representing, Vernacular Portraits of, by, and for African Americans. So just break that down. Representing, what does that mean?
Representing, I use that word because there are multiple ways we can look at it. Portraits or photographs of people, Polaroids, casual snapshots, they are all representations of an individual. It's not the full essence, of course, of who someone is, but they represent, they stand in for someone perhaps we know. So what a wonderful thing for us to have if we move away, if that person is lost to us through their moving away or through death. We have a physical representation of them on this little piece of paper or this piece of metal or in this album. I am also, through the exhibition, representing these photographs. These were photographs that were originally made for really private use. They were for photo albums. They were for people's walls. They were for the refrigerator door. And they were made for African Americans and people of color, most likely for other African Americans and other people of color. They were community-based, they were family-based, and it was a way, especially during the 19th and early 20th century, but this still continues certainly to this day, for people of color who are often, I think, represented only in one way, a very narrow way, or misrepresented in the press, in the popular press, in images that circulate outside of the African American community. This was a way for individuals to represent themselves the way they wanted to be represented and the way they saw themselves and understood one another in daily life and doing all of the things that people do. Mm-hmm. But we outside of that community were not necessarily being fed those images, whether through newspapers or on television, on postcards, and so on. So what is interesting to me, though, is these are private images, and I am representing them in the space of a museum. And what does that mean? Because these photographs are no longer with their families. They're from multiple collections. There are three collections altogether within the space of the exhibition. How did they leave their families? Why are we showing them in this white-walled, kind of rarefied space? And I don't necessarily have answers for what the meanings will bring up and what feelings will come up as these photographs are shown in this space. But I think it's important for people to know that we as curators and a museum don't often have all the answers, but maybe we should pose the question, what are these photographs like? Why did those of us outside of the community often not see them? What does that mean to the larger United States of America? Can we change that? Should we change that? And how do we do so?
And what about the word represent, which is used as sort of a term of approval? You know, people just say it like, hey, great. Mm-hmm. And what does that have a meaning here?
Well, I would think so. And having seen or heard that word in different places, certainly. And it is, depending on how people use the word, I would hope would be certainly a way of saying these are incredibly beautiful, meaningful, delightful photographs of communities that have not had an easy time in this United States of America and have been displaced. So I do see certainly in a number of the images a certain sense of pride, of relaxation, of middle class. A lot of times we do not see representations of African Americans as middle class or upper middle class, so that really restricts our understanding of different communities. And so they are beautiful and delightful and interesting and fun images of people.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. She is here talking about representing vernacular photographs of, by, and for African Americans. And it runs at the Portland Art Museum through December the 3rd. So in the title, you've also got of, by, and for. Where does that come from?
I love the words, first of all, because the photographs are so different. Some of the photographs are of African Americans, but they weren't made by African Americans. There were certainly studio photographers who were African American in the 19th century, but there weren't all that many. So many of the photographs, the portraits that were made from the years, say, 1870, when that's the earliest date really in the show, to about even 1935 or 1940, those portraits were of African Americans, but they weren't necessarily made by African Americans. They were certainly made for African Americans. And then the photographs that you see, the snapshots and the Polaroids, because those are personal cameras and easy ways of developing or getting the print back immediately in the case of the Polaroid, those are photographs that are most certainly of African Americans by African Americans, which I think is a really important relationship. When the photographer is also of the community, that can often change the tone of the image because of the relationship between the photographer and the sitter. So we need to think about that. And then these are all photographs that, for the most part, are for African Americans. But the term of, by, and for, of course, relates back to Gettysburg Address that Abraham Lincoln delivered in 1863 when he was talking about government of, by, and for the people. And in 1863, during the Civil War, what does that mean? Who is considered a person in the United States? Who has rights? And how does that translate to people who are still slaves at that time? And then freed men and women, are they truly people in the United States of America at this time, and how will things change as time goes on
throughout our history? Tell us about the picture of someone's grandkids. They're like two girls and a boy, and it just says grandchildren.
Oh,
what is that?
That was really wonderful. Part of many of the photographs that came from the North Portland collection. There were a number of photographs of one family, and the name Singleton came up quite often. Someone had handwritten on the photographs, and you can see that. These images aren't matted. They're actually cornered like they would be in a photo album, so that you can see them as things, as prints, as objects that have traveled through time and through places. And someone retroactively went through, and I'm so grateful to him or her, writing things like, you know, Noni's classmate, or so I was able to eventually figure out who Noni was. And then there was a series of photographs from Judge Singleton's family, and it said Omaha, Nebraska. So it said Judge Singleton, Omaha, Nebraska. So I was able to find information on Judge Singleton. And there's a beautiful photograph of Judge Singleton on his own, and then there's a wonderful one of a boy and two girls, really early, probably around 1910 or so. And I was able to find out that Judge Singleton was a justice of the peace in Omaha, and he was very, very active in sort of early civil rights movements before World War One. I believe
he was
passed
black.
Away in 1939. Yes, he was black, and his grandchildren. It's this beautiful, stunning portrait, and then perhaps some other family members as well. And these children are just delightfully clean and beautiful, long hair.
They've got
in
Beyonce
bows.
Hair. They've got long, straight hair.
Beautiful
blue eyes. Gigantic.
Well, we don't know that
bows.
They're blue eyes because it's a black and white photograph, but we might be able to interpret them as having lighter eyes.
Light eyes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, and beautiful frilly dresses, and the young gentleman is in a beautiful collared shirt and tie, and his hair is slicked back. So, and there's just a kind of a mottled background. We don't see much other than these lovely children. And as I was doing research on the Singleton family, I discovered that, you know, so we know that this man is a justice of the peace. He's doing wonderful work in his community. He's very, very active in terms of African-American rights. And I did also find out there was a news story printed in 1930 that his son, while his son was away, someone placed a burning cross on his son's front lawn. And Singleton, Judge Singleton's daughter-in-law and niece were in the house. And so he came over straight away and was able to extinguish it and pull it off the lawn. So I find it heartbreaking and also amazing to look at these photographs, these beautiful studio portraits of these important people and delightful people who have families and friends and are living their lives. And part of living their life is pulling down burning crosses.
Mm-hmm. I'm amazed that even made the newspaper.
Yeah, that, you know, that's a good point. I perhaps it happened. I'm not an expert on Omaha history. So did it happen less often there? Was it an African-American newspaper, because oftentimes certain communities would have their own newspapers, their own circulation? Or was it in the general Omaha newspaper? It's a good question. But it did make the news. Additional work came from two collectors. I kind of have an individual who bridges the earliest photographs and the latest photographs, and his name is Peter J. Cohen, and he lives in Manhattan, and he has over 50,000 photographs in his snapshot collection. And you should see, going to his loft space in Manhattan is incredible, and it's really fun. And curators from all over the world come to visit him, and he donates to museums worldwide.
Where does he get them all?
He gets them often. He's been collecting over 25 years. He's gotten them in yard sales. They started there. He started getting some on eBay. Friends will look for him now and send him images they think are important to him. But he has the most incredible collection of everyday snapshots you've ever seen. And he doesn't categorize them by year or by shape of photograph or anything like that. It's more by content. So he'll have a box of Halloween photographs or automobile photographs or women with guns, you know, that kind of thing. So going to his place is just like going to a candy shop if you're 7 years old.
But they're in boxes.
They're in boxes. They're right. Beautifully housed. He has an assistant, Yael, who she very carefully helps to group them, and then she also puts them in sleeves so they're well taken care of. So we're not like flipping through with our fingers after mm-hmm. eating lunch, touching yeah. the prints. They're all encased, and we can very carefully flip through them that way. And what? So I selected photographs from his collection, and he donated them to
oh,
us.
Oh, really?
He did.
What would it take to digitize his collection?
Oh, my goodness. A lot of time and some money, I'm sure. And little by little, he does it. He also has an Instagram okay. Yes. And
do you know what it is?
I think it's Peter J. Cohen Collection. Mm-hmm. We can verify that, mm-hmm. certainly. But if you were to just type in Peter J. Cohen in your search spot on Instagram, you'll be able to find
okay.
it.
Right.
Yeah. And so they post a number of times a week. And then the third collection, which gets us up to 2005, is an incredible collection of a selection of over 3,500 Polaroids that an artist named Chun Lee has put together. And he is a person of color, and he is very, very interested in what it means to be a man in the Black community, be a father in the Black community, and what types of representations we see in the popular press, what ways that African males are cast within the popular press, and are there alternative stories that he can bring about through images and through his own work. And so he has this incredible 3,500 plus Polaroid collection that he finds in yard sales, on eBay, places like that. And so some of his collection are incorporated into the exhibition as well. And the latest photograph we have is a Polaroid, and it was marked by hand by either the person who took the image or the person who possessed the image. 2005. Mm-hmm. So we have a span really of about 1870 to 2005.
And Chun Lee's Asian?
So Chun is now based in Toronto. And when he was being raised by his Korean mother and Korean stepfather, he was told and believed that he was 100% Korean. And in his early 30s or so, his mother finally told him that his birth father is Black. And so he did not know that, was not aware of it until, his early to mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And so that really pushed him onto a path of trying to determine his own history and what it means to be a Black male in the United States and, of course, in Canada, where he now lives.
Mm-hmm. And just briefly, you have another show after this in December. What's it called?
I do. It's called In the Beginning, Minor White's Photographs of Oregon. And Minor White is very well known for the later work that he did, especially at MIT, and a founder and editor of Aperture magazine, and these beautiful kind of spiritual photographs that he made that border on the abstract. But he really started his career here in Portland. So the exhibition is timed with our 125th anniversary of the museum. They are beautiful, beautiful photographs of Portland. And he moves out into Oregon a little bit as well between about 1938 and 1942. So we'll be celebrating the museum's anniversary with these incredible photographs
by
Minor White.
Are they landscapes? I mean, was this high art for him, or was he just... Were they snapshots?
Well, they aren't snapshots. They are larger negative photographs, sometimes 4x5, sometimes mm-hmm. a little bit smaller. But they were actually photographs that were commissioned, for the most part, by the government, by the Works Progress Administration during the Great Depression and right before World War II. And they were commissioned to remember, if you will, or to document different parts of Portland as it was changing. So Front Avenue, as a bill was being moved through to pull down those buildings and to make a different roadway because mm-hmm. there were more cars and so on. So he was tasked with photographing Front Avenue and all those beautiful mm-hmm. iron front buildings and so on before they were torn down. Mm. He also did magnificent images of the Portland waterfront and industry. So they were government produced photographs that now are in our collection here at the museum and are beautiful representations of Portland as it once was and to an extent still is. There are some places that those buildings still do exist, so we can enjoy those.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. She was here to talk about representing vernacular photographs of, by, and for African Americans, which runs now through December the 3rd. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO again.
Thank you so much.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Business of Diversity on August 7th at 11 a.m. at the Sentinel Hotel in Portland. The Business of Diversity will be a conversation about the impact of diversity on the economy and business in Oregon. This panel discussion features business owners, educators, and community leaders. Again, that's the Business of Diversity on August 7th at 11 a.m. at the Sentinel Hotel, 614 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Sunfest, August 4th through 6th at Mountaindale Sun Resort, one of the first nudist clubs in Oregon. Sunfest 2017 has a Roaring Twenties theme featuring camping, jazz, dancing, nude Olympics, and more. Again, that's Sunfest, the weekend of August 4th through the 6th at Mountaindale Sun Resort, 27100 Northwest Dairy Creek Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information.